Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
These discussions with paramilitaries were at play with death.
Remarkable personal stories from around the world.
They don't speak with words, they speak with guns.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 2nd of May, these are our main stories. Police in Georgia have fired tear gas at people protesting outside Parliament against legislation which they say is designed to stifle opposition to the government. The president of Columbia University in New York says the college has been pushed to the brink by pro-Palestinian protests. The team that designs and builds electric vehicle charging stations at Tesla say they've all been sacked. Also in this podcast.
Essentially, there were 4 million homes which were abandoned. The government doesn't know really who owns them. Nothing's been done with them. Many of them are just sitting there rotting.
So why are there so many abandoned houses across Japan? Find out later. We begin in Georgia, where the centre of the capital, Tbilisi, was brought to a standstill on Wednesday by protesters taking part in a large anti-government demonstration. Police fired tear gas to clear large crowds after legislators voted to give provisional approval to a new law. The foreign agents legislation requires organisations to state whether they are funded from abroad. These people explained why they were taking part in the protests.
With the second hearing, the law has been passed, which is absolutely ridiculous and stupid thing to do in this situation right now. We are going to stand till the end.
It's what we are afraid of more, being gassed, being beaten up, or losing the country. We're scared lifeless for losing the country to Russia and to the government of traitors.
More people are going to show up here, and this government has no chance to stay in power.
I spoke to our correspondent in Tbilisi, Rehan Dimitri, who was amongst the protesters.
As you can probably hear the noise, I had to step away slightly from the main protest area. But it's a really, really big crowd. Thousands, I don't know, maybe tens of thousands. And they're mainly young people. The police have already used repeatedly pepper sprays and water cannons. But people are refusing to disperse, so they're moving out of the area if they're being hit by the tear gas and then going back. And the vibe and the mood is people are just chanting Sakartvelo, which means Georgia. They are clapping. They're trying to kind of maybe cheer themselves up and to stay put where they are to continue their protest.
And Rehan, remind us what they are protesting about.
It started as a protest against a bill which the current administration is trying to pass. It's called On the Transparency of Foreign Funding. And it's the second attempt by the Georgian government to introduce this legislation in Georgia, the first attempt being last year. And they had to pull back because there were mass protests then. So this year they reintroduced this law. And why is this law controversial or is seen as being controversial? Because it targets Georgia's civil society. It targets non-governmental organizations and independent media. It's been dubbed as the Russian law or kind of Russian-inspired law. But I think the protests now increasingly are against the government. And people are referring to the current government here as the Russian government. A short while ago, I was in the nearby park, just near the protest area, because this protest is spread out to quite a large area. As I mentioned, people are moving in and out. And there were printouts of Bidzina Ivanishvili. He's the founder of the governing party called the Georgian Dream. He is Georgia's richest man. And he recently made a political comeback. So there were printouts of him and just lying on the ground. And people were walking and stepping on it with pleasure, I would say. And people are really angry at Bedin Ivanishvili and his whole political team for ignoring their voices, for really not commenting and not saying anything about this ongoing protest.
Rehan Dimitri in Georgia. For months now, the impact of the Israeli airstrikes and ground campaign in Gaza has prompted protests and marches in countries around the world. It's raised questions about what is an acceptable form of protest, how should people behave, which banners and chants are seen as legitimate and which are anti-Semitic or incite violence. All those issues have come to the fore in America in recent days as protests at a number of universities have led to hundreds of people being arrested. On Wednesday evening, our correspondent Tom Bateman filed this report from Texas.
Well, here in Dallas on the University of Texas campus, this was a peaceful protest, singing, chanting. About 150 to 200 people were here, and the state troopers are moving in on us again. About 150 to 200 people were here, singing, chanting, waving flags. There was then pretty quickly a notice handed out by the university administration telling the protesters that the encampment, the tents and the gazebos had to be removed immediately because they were in breach of university rules, or that they would be taken down. We then saw state troopers, riot police armed with batons, they've got cable tied, zip tie handcuffs, in riot gear, then began to move in on this encampment. In waves, they forced down the barricades that the protesters had put in front of them. They're ripping down gazebos at the moment and tents. And some of the protesters joined hands in the middle of the encampment here and were forcibly dragged away by the state authorities. The effect it's had is to utterly change the mood here. So there's now a lot of anger, chants of shame on you. Some saying, where were you in Uvalde? The sense of tension and emotion that high transformed the mood here, as there is now a standoff between the state troopers and the protesters.
Earlier in the day, our correspondent Emma Vardy captured the mood in Los Angeles.
This was the moment tensions between rival protesters boiled over. Pro-Palestinian activists and a counter-demonstration by pro-Israel supporters became violent. Fireworks were thrown, wooden barricades used as weapons.
We had people mazing us, beating us with bats and sticks, throwing whatever they could to us.
I'm kind of annoyed at myself for not seeing it coming, but I just didn't think that it would ever get to this, escalate to this level.
The Los Angeles police were called in by the university. Eventually, officers separated the rival groups.
I'm a UCLA student. I deserve to go here. We pay tuition. This is our school. And they're not letting me walk in.
Some Jewish students say they felt threatened by the protests and have been blocked by demonstrators from walking across campus.
I do not condone the actions of this pro-Israel mob. They were not UCLA students. They were people in their late 20s, early 30s. That came in here and took matters into their own hands. But I do have to say, I understand why they did it, because in their eyes, they could see as that UCLA administration was not doing anything about this anti-Semitism that is boiling in our backyard here at UCLA.
As encampments have grown, there's been disruption for many students in LA, with campuses closed and graduation ceremonies scaled back. There's particular frustration today for students who would have been taking exams. Instead, a heavy police presence on campus will continue.
On Tuesday, there were also demonstrations at Columbia and the City University of New York, both ending in clashes. At Columbia, one of the buildings was taken over by protesters who barricaded themselves in and hung a Palestinian flag out of a window. New York City's mayor, Eric Adams, said the ringleaders of the break-in were not connected with the university.
Well, those who broke into the building did include students. It was led by individuals who are not affiliated with the university. The school needed the NYPD's assistance to clear Hamilton Hall and the encampments outside. A dual operation on the grounds that took place successfully.
Senators gathered in Washington to talk about the protests as well. Republican Senator Tom Cotton called for President Biden to condemn the campus protests.
These criminals are chanting eliminationist slogans like, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, and globalize the Intifada. At Stanford, they wore Hamas headbands. At Princeton, they flew the Hezbollah flag. At George Washington University, they called for the final solution and posted signs saying they wouldn't leave until Jews go back to their real homes.
The U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, held talks in Israel on Wednesday for the seventh time since the Hamas attacks on October the 7th of last year. He met the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who has continued to make clear that he intends to go ahead with an offensive in the city of Rafah in southern Gaza, with or without a ceasefire agreement. And that is something Washington says it's strongly opposed to. After the talks, Mr. Blinken visited the Keren Shalom crossing at the southern end of the Gaza Strip, where he saw dozens of trucks waiting to enter Gaza. He renewed his call for Hamas to accept the ceasefire deal.
What we discussed today, among other things, was getting this agreement, which involves an immediate ceasefire, hostages home, and then working to build on it. And that's what we talked about today. So let's see if we can get this done. Look, I think this is something that the whole world is watching. And if Hamas actually purports to care about the Palestinian people, and wants to see an immediate alleviation of their suffering, it will take the deal.
Earlier, the Erez crossing into northern Gaza was opened to allow more aid into the territory. So are there any signs of an imminent deal? Our security correspondent Frank Gardner is in Jerusalem.
Not that has been made public, no. I mean, Hamas did issue a sort of interim statement, essentially calling on Secretary Blinken to stop putting pressure on them, saying, you know, because he's been saying it's on Hamas now, it's up to them, and if this deal doesn't go through, it's the fault of Hamas. They are studying the deal, but I think their fundamental misgiving about it is that it does not include a full and permanent ceasefire, which is what they want, and Israel won't agree to that. This is a temporary pause in the fighting as far as Israel's concerned. I also think it's an important point to make clear here, because, you know, I listened to all of the press conference that Antony Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, gave today in Ashdod, in southern Israel. And listening to him, you got the impression that this deal that's on the table is going to get all the hostages out. It isn't. Even if it goes ahead, we are talking at most about a third of the remaining hostages who are thought to be still alive. Hamas are not going to give up the other ones easily. You know, this is their kind of, not exactly their insurance, but, you know, if they give up all their hostages, they will worry that they've got, you know, there's absolutely nothing to stop them being finished off. Now, maybe that's going to happen anyhow. Remember that the US is not keen on the Rafah offensive, not because they've got any misgivings about finishing off Hamas, but they're worried about the high concentration of civilians in Rafah. That's why they don't want the offensive to go ahead.
Frank Gardner in Jerusalem. While Israel has been fighting its war against Hamas in Gaza, its northern border with Lebanon has seen daily exchanges with Hezbollah. Like Hamas, Hezbollah is backed by Iran and proscribed as a terrorist organisation by the UK government and others. Hezbollah has launched rocket and drones against Israel since October the 7th. The Israeli military has hit back hard, hitting thousands of targets in southern Lebanon. Our correspondent Karine Torbe has been on patrol there with the UN's peacekeeping force.
Travelling to south of Lebanon is a risky journey. Accompanied by the Lebanese army, we moved closer to the damaged towns dotted along this border area. Israel lies on the other side.
We are traveling with the UN to several towns in southern Lebanon. These towns have been heavily bombed for 7 months now. That's why we went with the UN, the safest way to have a first-hand look into what is happening on this front.
Empty villages, abandoned homes. Peaceful life here has been erased. Feels like in no man's land. mangled mound of cement and metal was a family home. It was hit by an Israeli strike just a few days before our visit. Little left of the home it had been.
The family who lived here left months ago.
Tens of thousands of people have fled in fear. Israeli military strikes that were limited in scope have expanded, leaving towns across the south deserted and destroyed.
This was a coffee shop, and next to it, here, was a two-story building standing. Now, it's reduced to one massive hole in the ground.
As we were leaving the area, it was hit by an Israeli airstrike. Israel says it hit 40 Hezbollah targets on this day, mainly in the border town of Ait Ashab, just a few miles from our patrol. Hussein is from the town, but he's now staying with his family in an apartment on the outskirts of Beirut. They left with what they could carry on the very first day of the border hostilities. We showed him footage of the town filmed by us back in October. He said many of the buildings are now totally destroyed. I told him that Israel claims it is targeting Hezbollah's fighters.
They are targeting civilians' houses. It's systematic destruction. It's not true they are just responding to attacks.
Back on the road, despite the intense violence, the UN peacekeeping forces still think they have a role to play.
Many people are tired of the situation, and I can imagine people are tired also in the other side of the conflict. So I think it's time for peace. The next challenge for UNIFIL will be to help and support the local population in returning back to their homes.
Since the beginning of the war in Gaza, this front has been more of a sideshow. Fears are that at any moment it could take the center stage.
That report by Karine Torbay in southern Lebanon. In the US, Manhattan's district attorney says the disgraced Hollywood film producer Harvey Weinstein will be retried in New York after having his 2020 rape conviction overturned on appeal last week. Weinstein's conviction was seen as a historic milestone for the Me Too movement, which saw hundreds of men accused of sexual misconduct. He's still in custody because of a separate conviction for rape in California, for which he's serving 16 years. From New York, Neda Torfik reports.
Prosecutors told the judge that they still had confidence in their case. They appeared in court with Jessica Mann, one of the two women who helped put Weinstein in jail in the New York case, and said she was there to show that she's not backing down, that while Weinstein may have power and privilege, she has the truth. Gloria Allred, who represents the other accuser, Mimi Halei, said her client was still deciding whether to testify, noting it wasn't an easy decision for her. Speaking to reporters, Ms. Allred said many had asked her about the future of the Me Too movement.
This movement is alive and well in New York, in California, and in many other states.
Harvey Weinstein, wearing a navy blue suit and a light blue tie, was brought into the courtroom in a wheelchair. His lawyer, Arthur Idala, said he was suffering serious medical issues, but was sharp as a tack. He proclaimed Weinstein's innocence.
We're very confident that if it goes to trial, the only words we'll hear at the end of the trial are, not guilty.
The disgraced movie mogul will remain in custody in New York until he is retried, which the judge said could happen in September.
Neda Torfik in New York. Next to Japan, a country that has a people problem. The government estimates that the current population of 127 million will fall to under 90 million by 2060. And that means issues for the economy and society as a whole. One of the most obvious effects of that are the number of vacant houses, known as akaya. New figures show the country has nearly 4 million abandoned homes. Most of them are in rural areas. Our Asia-Pacific editor, Mickey Bristow, told us more.
Staggering numbers, as you said just then. Essentially, there were 4 million homes which were abandoned. The government doesn't know really who owns them. Nothing's been done with them. Many of them are just sitting there rotting, vines all over them, or nature's gradually taken over. So they're just sitting there. Nothing has been done with them. That's part of a bigger number, 9 million homes which are empty across Japan. And that includes, this bigger number includes homes which are for sale, second homes, and those are for rent. But most of those homes, extra homes, are for rent. And most of those have been on the market for a lot of time. So you can see there are millions and millions of homes in Japan which have been unoccupied for a long period of time.
And so how has it come to this? Is it all about demographics?
Mostly about demographics. There are a couple of things going on. Firstly, there's a shrinking population in Japan, so there's less demand for homes because simply there were fewer people. There's also a movement from the countryside towards cities. So many of these homes, these Akiya homes, are in the countryside. And that's because people, not only are there fewer people, but people are leaving the countryside for the cities. So those are the demographic reasons. Also, there are a number of government and bureaucratic reasons. So, for example, it's cheaper to have a home on a piece of land than to clear it and have clear land. It's fewer taxes on. So there's no real incentive on people to knock down a home. And so essentially you've got all these homes in rural areas. People often inherit them, but they live in the cities perhaps, and they don't want, they can't sell them, they can't rent them out, there's nobody to rent them, and they can't demolish them either because it's too expensive to do that, so they're just sitting there.
There is a suggestion that actually it might be a very attractive proposition for foreigners, for people from abroad, tourists who want a cheap property.
Yeah, there is a movement of people who have sort of like seen these cheap properties in Japan, helped because of the falling value of the yen. So lots of tourists at the moment are currently making the way to Japan because it's cheaper. Houses are cheaper as well. There is a caveat to that, and lots of foreigners are being warned that once you get here, a lot of these homes are in really rural places out of the way, so there's no facilities, hospitals, supermarkets nearby. Also, there are not necessarily a lot of people, workmen available to do them up, and it might cost a lot of money to repair them. So you get the house cheap, but you really don't have enough money to do it up.
Mickey Bristow. Still to come.
It's a terrible infection. We've known about it for over 20 years. Decimates bird populations, and it's hard to get rid of.
Scientists around the world are keeping an eye on an unfolding bird flu outbreak in the US.
Up there, you have to be quick to make decisions because it's not a natural environment for survival.
Five incredible women. Mountaineers who put everything on the line to follow their dreams.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service tells their story in Chasing Mountains.
I risked my life many times.
To be the first to climb all 8,000 meter peaks.
I had to finish it, accomplish it.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. In this world, nothing can be said to be certain except death and taxes. So said Benjamin Franklin, one of America's founding fathers. But in Pakistan, the payment and collection of taxes is far from certain. It's estimated that just 2% of the country's 240 million people pay income tax. And that's a problem for the government as it wrestles with a severe economic crisis and eye-watering levels of international debt. And so it's pulling out a big stick to try to persuade more people to cough up what they owe. It's asked the telecom authorities to block the SIM cards of more than 500,000 people who've yet to file their tax returns for this year. And that means no calls, no internet access. Shahbaz Rana, economics correspondent at Pakistan's Express Tribune, told James Menendez more.
We had seen a similar move back in 2011 when the then government had tried to suspend the national identity cards of the non-filers of the income tax returns. But that bill did not pass through. And the reason was that it is the fundamental right of people of Pakistan to get certain services, and those services would not be available to people without the national identity card. Right. Here the question arises, should the government of Pakistan disconnect the mobile SIM cards? Would it lead us to the next question, which is the fundamental rights of the people of Pakistan, that includes the internet services? But the counter argument is here, that the Pakistani laws, they require at the same time that the people, they should comply with the law and they should file their annual income tax returns.
Why do so few people pay income tax? Isn't it like about 2% or something of the population?
Well, at this point in time, only 4.5 million people and the companies have file their annual income tax returns. The number is quite low when you compare it with Pakistani population, which is roughly 250 million people. According to the FBI's own estimates, at least 10 million people should have filed their annual income tax returns.
What's your explanation? I mean, no one around the world likes paying tax, but what is it about Pakistanis? Do they just really, really resent having to pay tax?
Well, the problem is that if you are caught in the West, then there is no remedy available to you. You have to pay a price. You have to pay a penalty. The problem with a country like Pakistan is that after a few years, every government that is in the power, it would try to give a tax amnesty scheme where, because of your status of non-filer, if you are caught, you have to pay, let's say, 70% of your total income in the tax. But the government of Pakistan offers an amnesty scheme at the rate of 3% to 5%. So people would prefer to wait for 3 to 4 years down the line, and they would get an opportunity for a tax amnesty scheme and go away with their money. And the second problem is with the corruption in the Pakistani tax system. And you know, the problem also lies with the taxman. One important step that the Prime Minister of Pakistan has taken just last week, he removed at least 25 top-tier taxmen from their position, because there were reports against them by the country's intelligence agencies that these people were either involved in some corrupt practices or they were lacking the competency to run those offices. So these kind of measures, like removing the officers from their positions, blocking the SIM cards, now the government of Pakistan hopes that compel people to come in the tax net.
Shahbaz Rana from the Express Tribune in Pakistan. A new exhibition has opened in Moscow featuring Western military machinery and firearms seized by Russian troops in Ukraine. The display, which includes army vehicles from 12 different countries as well as NATO equipment, coincides with Russia's Victory Day celebrations to commemorate the end of the Second World War. Our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg has been taking a look.
Russia Today showed off its war trophies. In Moscow's Victory Park, the gates opened on a brand new display. The Russian public crowded around the unusual exhibits. Western military hardware captured during Russia's war in Ukraine. There were Western tanks that had been given to Kiev, an American Abrams, and a Leopard tank from Germany. I saw a British Army Husky tactical support vehicle too, with bullet holes in its windscreen. Visitors seemed impressed. It's incredible, jaw-dropping, said Natalia, who was here with her husband and small daughter. It's amazing to think that our guys managed to get these trophies. But why display them? The Russians have not invented the wheel here. In the past, Ukraine has exhibited Russian military hardware captured by the Ukrainian army. But in Russia's case, I think this exhibition has two main aims. First, to reinforce the Kremlin's narrative that in Ukraine, the West is waging war against Russia, although in reality, it was Russia that invaded Ukraine. But also to convince the Russian people that in Ukraine, Russia will emerge victorious. A large sign at the exhibition carried the key message: our victory is inevitable.
Steve Rosenberg in Russia. Staff at Tesla say the entire team at the carmaker's supercharger division have been fired. The division was responsible for designing the electric vehicle chargers and deploying them worldwide. Hundreds of employees worked with the team. Our technology editor Zoe Kleinman reports.
In an internal memo, the co-founder Elon Musk wrote that the firm had to be absolutely hardcore about headcount and cost reduction and has said the company would cut 1 in 10 jobs. But the supercharger network has been considered to be a success, so disbanding the team behind it is surprising and perhaps a glimpse at just how serious Tesla's financial woes currently are. The firm might be aiming for China to help change its fortunes. A new partnership with the Chinese giant Baidu could allow Tesla to go ahead with some autonomous driving technology inside the country.
Zoe Kleinman. Scientists around the world are keeping an eye on an unfolding bird flu outbreak in the United States. The virus has infected herds of cattle in 9 states. It's reported that one Texas dairy worker has tested positive for the virus. So, how worried should we be about bird flu? James Reynolds spoke to Dr. Isaac Bogoch, infectious diseases expert and professor at the University of Toronto. He first asked him to explain what exactly is bird flu.
It's a terrible infection. We've known about it for over 20 years. Decimates bird populations, and it's hard to get rid of because it's in wild birds and migratory birds. So you can see how it can spread all over the world. These birds die. And then what's happening is scavenging animals, can be in close contact with dead or dying birds or their feces. They can pick up this infection, and it's also rather devastating to many mammal species. So you've seen die-offs of sea lions, die-offs of coyotes, cats. But then it got into dairy cows, and the issue is that's a food security problem, and it's far more widespread than initially thought. We don't want this infection to be in any animal, let alone in mammals, because currently, it's not very easily transmitted from mammal to mammal. The concern is if we give it opportunities to be transmitted from mammal to mammal, it could mutate and it can be more readily transmitted between mammals. And that's obviously a problem for mammals, and including our food supply and including humans. We do not want an epidemic or a pandemic again.
And anyone who's of a certain age will remember that there have been previous bouts of bird flu, which have been heavily monitored. I remember working in the BBC's Beijing offices, Dr. Isaac, years ago, and we had a supply of medication in one of the cupboards. We had to keep checking to make sure it hadn't expired, it hadn't gone past its sell-by date. How does this, what we're seeing now, compare to previous years?
The burden globally is much higher than in years past, and the burden not just in birds. We've never seen it in dairy cows before. It hasn't impacted food security to this extent before, and it's important to keep a close watch on this. We've known this virus has had epidemic and pandemic potential for over 20 years, and to see it spread in mammalian species is very concerning.
On your list of huge priorities as a doctor, a scientist, you've treated COVID. Where does monitoring bird flu rank on your current list of what you're keeping an eye on?
It's the top. It's really high. Anytime you have an infection with epidemic or pandemic potential and it's doing things that you haven't really seen it done before, it should raise significant red flag that's important for the world to take notice. Not to throw anyone under the bus, but there was a bit of a sluggish initial response in the United States to this. And that's unfortunate. We've just been through a terrible pandemic. We know how important it is to be fast, to cast a broad net, to take things very seriously up front to prevent further spread. And, I think they're taking it rather seriously now, but the initial couple of weeks after learning about this in cows was a bit sluggish, not the most transparent communication. And obviously things have turned around, but, this is an important infection. It's probably widespread elsewhere in the other parts of the world. We're just not looking for it. We need to do better.
Dr. Isaac Bogoch from the University of Toronto. Now, there are a few things that provoke as much passion in the world as professional sport. But what about if our childhood heroes just aren't quite as enthusiastic about it as we are? On Wednesday, mixed martial arts and UFC star Stuart Austin has admitted that he actually hates fighting. Alfie Habershed reports.
As two fighters step into the cage, the crowd roars around them. For months, they've exchanged abuse at press conferences, and money and fame is on the line. As the bell rings, fists fly and legs flail as both try to knock each other to the floor. And it's often a game of willpower, where you can win by smashing your opponent into knockout or by making them submit from pure pain. So the question is, how could you possibly set foot inside that cage if you didn't enjoy it?
Well, that's what British heavyweight fighter Stuart Austin is saying. In fact, he's compared it to a job interview, which he finds horrible and stressful. And safe to say, it's come as a bit of a shock. Because after all, UFC's biggest star Conor McGregor famously likened his obsession with the sport to Vincent van Gogh's with art.
I've lost my mind on this game, yeah? Like Vincent van Gogh. He dedicated his life to his art and lost his mind in the process. That's happened to me.
But Austin isn't the first athlete to let it slip that he's not that keen on his job. Welsh former Real Madrid footballer Gareth Bale may have been champion of Europe five times, but he says when the football's on the TV, he tends to switch over. And while seven-time world champion Ronnie O'Sullivan makes snooker look effortless, he says he actually finds it a bit of a hassle, and that the best thing about it is it simply gives him money to do other stuff. Of course, it's always a bit embarrassing when our childhood heroes, who we endlessly talk about, don't really share our passion for what they do. And that, like for most of us, they're actually just going to work. But in the case of Austin, it may be worth considering how much we would really fancy stepping into that cage ourselves.
That report was by Alfie Habersham. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Nora Houle. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
The mountains are what keeps me motivated in life.
It's where we get to ask ourselves who we are and who we want to become.
At the turn of this century, five mountaineers set out on individual missions to become the first woman to scale all 14 of the world's 8,000ers. 14 mountains, all above 8,000 meters.
It was about pitting themselves against nature rather than each other.
They knew only one of them would succeed. But whether they liked it or not, it would come to be seen as a race.
Five women vying against each other.
The media needed to find some competition, and they find it.
A race with deadly consequences.
We are just not designed to live in this environment.
Getting down alive was my only goal in that situation.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story in Chasing Mountains.
Every step was an achievement.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.